The Federalist Papers was presented by Charlie Dewberry at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, today we're going to shift gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about the founding fathers and what their take was on radical democracy and versus representative democracy. And this afternoon, we're going to look at political equality and biblical equality. But I want to highlight that I'm going to make a few comments about equality from the perspective of the founding fathers, in particular, the individuals that wrote the Federalist Papers. Okay. Background, a little bit of background for the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers were a series of 85 essays that were published mostly in New York State. They were written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. And they were published over about a two-year period from 1787 to 1789. Their purpose was to try to convince New York citizens to ratify the proposed Constitution. Who were these people? Well, first, the spearhead of it was Hamilton. And Hamilton is an interesting character. He was in New York at the time. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, one of three from New York, although he didn't attend much of it, because the other two delegates were always going to vote against him. And the way the Constitutional Convention was set up, you only had one vote per state. So how many ever delegates you had, those number of delegates had to vote, and then there was a one vote per state. So he was always outvoted, so he just didn't bother to go for most of it. Well, what was interesting, when he quit going, then the other two guys quit going as well. Well, you'd think, well, now he can come back and vote. No, it wasn't set up that way. He couldn't vote unless the other two guys voted as well. And so he didn't show up again until the last 3 or 4 weeks of the convention. I highlight this just to point out, as we go through some of this, just the idiosyncrasies of how a lot of these conventions and things were put together and the deals that had to be made to even get these things off the ground. So first, Hamilton, as I remember, he was born in the Caribbean. I think it's the Virgin Islands, but I'm not sure. Does anybody know for sure? Anyway, I was going to look that up and couldn't find it quickly, so, but I'm pretty sure it was the Virgin Islands. Just a couple comments. He was an interesting character in that his take on the convention was, this isn't going to work at all, because the view he had when he went to the convention was, he wanted an individual who was going to be president or leader, elected for life, and that person would have total veto power. That was his take on the federal, on his take on a national government and the role of the national government in a federalism that I'll talk about before. So it's kind of strange that Hamilton's one of the authors of the Federalist Papers, because what he's actually trying to argue them to accept and ratify is light years away from what his personal view was. Second person was John Jay. He wasn't a delegate at all to the convention, but he actually took over. He had tried to spearhead the ratification within New York of the proposed Constitution. And so he ultimately is the prime mover behind it. The third person was James Madison. And what's interesting about Madison is you couldn't find anybody probably in greater disagreement with Hamilton than Madison. And Madison wasn't even asked to write them to start with, first point being he was from Virginia. And so why is this guy from Virginia going to, why does he even care about whether New York ratifies this thing or not? What's at issue? So I'm going to make more comments about Madison later, so I'll flesh out more on him personally later. But just to comment here, Madison was actually a pretty good choice, because if there is one person that wrote the Constitution, it's James Madison. In fact, he had what amounted to the only set of notes at the end of what happened during the convention. And he probably spoke the most at the convention, although, curiously, most of his major key proposals were all defeated. So, but he was probably the best choice Hamilton could have made, even though he was third or fourth choice, in truth of the matter be known. To sum up Madison's view in one point, it would be no man or no group can be trusted with power. That's Madison's perspective. But the Federalists were all in agreement on this, that the proposed Constitution was actually too weak to be effective, but they all were of the belief that if it didn't pass, the nation would not endure. And they all three were shocked to learn that the majority of people who were probably going to vote on it thought that the proposed Constitution was too centralistic and too dangerous. And so they were all in agreement, really, on those three things. And so that's what made them strange bedfellows in writing the Federalist Papers. Now, the first thing to know about the Federalist Papers is it's difficult to know exactly what each of them really believes, because their purpose is to convince the state of New York to ratify this thing. That's its purpose, and that's its sole purpose. Why is this a big deal? Why is this ratification a big deal? And I'm only going to hint at this. I'll talk more about it in the lecture. But the convention was actually called to propose amendments to the Articles of Confederation. Now, they all sort of knew that it was going to be a pretty major overhaul. But they didn't know how big an overhaul they were actually going to propose. They were proposing a document that superseded the Articles of Confederation. Under the Articles of Confederation, the way it worked is the Constitutional Convention proposed an amendment, and it had to be ratified by all 13 states. If it wasn't ratified by all 13 states, it wasn't binding. The new document said that 9 states had to ratify it. Well, first you got to get 9, but then there's the issue, what if you get 9 and you don't have 12? What are we going to do here? Because in a sense, this Constitutional Convention superseded its authority and wrote a document that superseded the authority they had. So there's the glitch. That's why ratification is really crucial politically. And New York was the most populous state at the time, and the leading opponent within the leading 13 states was the governor of New York, George Clinton. So that's what they're facing. And as I mentioned, that when Hamilton left, the other two delegates from New York left too. Their names were Yates and Lansing. They actually were cronies of Clinton. So they immediately went back to him and said, you're not going to like this thing that's coming. We got to do something about this. And they told him to really expect the absolute worst when the final document came out. And it met their expectations. Well, what they did then was write a series of articles attacking the delegates for first exceeding the scope of the work they'd been given. They had no authority to do this, firstly. And secondly, the core of their argument against it on content was it came from Montesquieu's Spirit of Laws. And at that time, Montesquieu was one of two or three of the real rock stars for them as far as political theory was concerned. And the quote that they highlighted over and over again is this: "It is natural to a republic to have only a small territory, otherwise it can't long subsist. And a large one, there are men of large fortunes and consequently of less moderation. There are two great deposits to trust in the hands of a single subject. An ambitious person soon becomes sensible that he can be happy, great, and glorious by oppressing his fellow citizens, and he'll raise himself to grandeur at their expense." His view is that in a large republic, public goods are sacrificed by having 1,000 of these individuals, all who have their own agenda. Therefore, nobody can actually see the effects or see what these people are intending and what the consequences are. So in Montesquieu's perspective, in large republics, you're always going to sacrifice the public good because there's thousands of these big, ambitious people only looking out for themselves, and no one can keep track of all the issues and all the implications of any one of their particular plans. In a small republic, and by small, he means like a Greek city-state, meaning a city. In a Greek city-state, you're only going to have one or two of these guys, and if they propose something, you're going to know if it's going to impact you. And so that's where Montesquieu is coming from. So in his view, a large republic is a formula for disaster. In just a couple minutes then, I want to give you just an overview of Federalist Number 9, which was the one before Federalist 10, written by Hamilton. And Hamilton's going to take this topic on directly. And here's Hamilton's critique of Montesquieu's point. In the beginning, not surprisingly from what I've told you about Hamilton, he believes that first union is going to be the best barrier against factions and insurrection and this instability. And so when he looked at history, he looked at the Greek city-states and Roman cities, and he looked at it with horror because democracies and those democracies in those city-states just bounce between tyranny and anarchy, pretty much. That was his conclusion. And so Hamilton tried to argue that large size is actually advantageous because the larger the state, it's less likely that you're actually going to get a faction that's or an insurrection that's going to blow the thing up. So, for example, if you're in Rhode Island and an insurrection of 5,000 people rises up at this time, you're toast. But if you're a large republic and you get a 5,000-man revolution or insurrection in Rhode Island, less of a big deal because you're big enough now that the rest of it's going to say, whoa, that's not in our common interest. That's not a good thing to have happen. Therefore, we can squash it. And so what Hamilton's claiming is that Montesquieu is actually wrong on that point. And then he turns around and finds other points of Montesquieu where he basically says the same thing. The problem with all those city-states was they needed to get together and ally themselves in a big enough political unit so that they can't be smashed by either adjacent bigger powers, or they can handle insurrections of one or two of their small major cities. That's the argument Hamilton had made. And so the issue was, and Hamilton realized that he's just taken on the rock star of their political theorists, and that's his argument. And so he realizes that a better argument needs to be formulated. That's the context of Federalist 10 and why he asked Madison to write it. And I'll stop here and just say, so that's the setup for Federalist 10. That's what it's about. One last comment about the Federalist 10. Whenever we hear the word federal now, we think national government. I just want to highlight one thing here that's really important. When they use the word federal, they don't mean national government. What they mean is a federal government. Now, what do they mean by federal government? They mean a government where there is different levels of government, each with their own scope of authority and power. So when they talk about a federal government, they're talking about, so remember, they're under the Articles of Confederation, which basically means the states are sovereign, they're the political unit that counts. The higher authority, they are under the Articles of Confederation, they deal with things like treaties, those kinds of things, but ultimately the power rests with the states. What the Federalists are claiming is we're not taking away states. States are still going to be very powerful entities, but when it comes to certain things like national defense, like treaties, like taxes, certain kinds of taxes and tariffs, that's going to be within the sphere of the national government. So this federal government is layers of government, each with their own set of authorities and priorities. That's what they mean by a federal government. And that has shifted quite considerably from the time they wrote, so I wanted to highlight that. So anyway, that's the context for Federalist 10. Yeah? Uh-huh. Well, would a federation be how they see federal? I would say not entirely, because a federation can be set up in a number of ways that would not fit federal in this context, it seems to me. So what they're specifically saying now is think of something like national defense. That's a big issue for them. In fact, until the 20th century, no one really looked at the Federalist Papers for much anything other than that. And so what they're arguing is this group of 13 states, if they're just in this Articles of Confederation, well, they vote and they decide as individuals when one is attacked whether they're even going to participate. If you have a federal government, that means you're all part of this one national entity. The national entity would be in charge of the military, not each state, and each state decide whether they're going to send anybody to fight. So if an insurrection starts in Massachusetts, which happened, is New York going to send anybody? Why should they? Well, if it spills over, that's a big deal, so maybe we should. But see the dilemma you get into. So explicitly what they mean is they want this national government to have some powers that are being taken away from the state, but the federal government is going to be highly restricted in the areas in which it has power. That's what they mean by a federation, by a federal government. So, but a federation could be a much broader term, you know. I mean, I could think of all kinds of federations.